potential 2024 matchup, arguing that the former commander-in-chief would be seen as an extreme candidate. During an interview on ABC's This Week programme, Chris Sununu was frank with journalist Jonathan Karl when asked about his thoughts on Donald Trump's prospects should the former president win the GOP nomination for the White House next year. Unfortunately, at the end of the day, November of 2022 showed us that, right? Trump is going to be seen as a very extreme candidate. The country is going to push back against it, the governor said. On Sunday, 5th of February, a newly released Washington Post ABC News poll showed Donald Trump narrowly leading Joe Biden 48% to 44% among registered voters, with Democrats overwhelmingly backing the president and Republicans firmly behind the former president. The results showed Donald Trump with a 50% to a 41% lead among independents, which helped give him a slight edge in the survey. Still, the governor, Chris Sununu, was not convinced that Donald Trump would be truly competitive with Joe Biden next year. Just look at the results of 3 months ago, and that shows you where extreme candidates are going to end up falling. It can't get done, he told Jonathan Karl. He could get the Republican nomination, but he can't get the job done. New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, who has been critical of Joe Biden's presidency, said that GOP voters need to nominate the most conservative candidate who can win a general election. The governor, who was elected to his fourth term in office last November, told Jonathan Karl that he was still mulling a presidential campaign of his own. I'm definitely thinking about it, having those conversations, but at the end of the day, you're going to have a lot of Republicans that get into that race, he said. They're all really good people. They're all really good candidates. You have Nikki Haley and Mike Pompeo and Governor Ron DeSantis, and a lot of folks are going to get in. At the moment, Donald Trump remains the only declared major candidate in the race, while Nikki Haley is set to enter the contest later on this month.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
One of Joe Biden's promises during his presidential campaign was to immediately move to end all support for the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen. In February 2021, Biden stood at a podium at the State Department and proclaimed that the war in Yemen must end. Biden underlined the humanitarian crisis as the key reason the United States withdrew support.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
An investigation by the Government Accountability Office found that the United States is training the Saudi-led coalition and the U.S. has troops on the ground in Yemen. Biden confirmed that the United States has troops in Yemen in a letter to Congress in June last year. Simply put, he lied to the world when he claimed that the United States was withdrawing U.S. troops for the war in Yemen in 2021. On the contrary, the United States is making billions of dollars from the war in Yemen, as 200,000 have been killed from direct violence. According to data acquired from the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, between 2015 and 2021, the United States sent $54.2 billion in weapons and services to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. In addition, the Department of Defense provided $644 million for military training to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, almost entirely primarily through the Foreign Military Sales Program. The DoD uses acquisition and cross-servicing agreements to bill nations for logistical support and items ranging from flying hours, fuel, and bombs. Saudi Arabia paid the United States $157 million in flying hours, and the UAE paid $104 million for flying hours since the Saudi-led intervention began in Yemen in 2015. The United States billed Saudi Arabia and the UAE for $319 million in acquisition and cross-servicing agreements for logistical support. Also, the United States sent $18.6 billion in missiles, $6.2 billion in aircraft, $3.3 billion in ships, and $2.8 billion in military training to attack one of the poorest nations in the world. The United States is well aware that the coalition is not fighting an advanced military in Yemen. Billions of dollars have been spent destroying the country, killing hundreds of thousands of people. The UN Security Council approved a resolution to blockade Yemen since 2015 to prevent arms from flooding the conflict. However, the embargo has only succeeded in starving the Yemenis into famine. On a February 9th phone call in 2022 with the King of Saudi Arabia, Salman bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, Biden assured him that the United States would continue to support the war in Yemen. The phone call came 1 year after Biden lied to the world and announced that the U.S. was withdrawing its support of the war in Yemen. The Defense Security Cooperation Agency's Defense Institute of International Legal Studies conducted training at the Saudi War College that focused on the law of armed conflict, including laws related to air-to-ground targeting in May 2017, April 2018, June 2019, and May 2020. The DoD claims they are not responsible for civilian deaths because they provided the Saudis with training to avoid civilian casualties. According to the Yemen Data Project, over 23,000 Saudi-led coalition airstrikes since March 2015 have led to thousands of civilian casualties. A Yemeni human rights organization has warned that the Saudi-led war on Yemen, as well as the crippling siege in the impoverished Arab country, could result in the death of thousands of children suffering from cancer. Intisaf, Organization for Women's and Children's Rights, said in a statement on the occasion of World Cancer Day that more than 3,000 Yemeni children who have developed cancer as a result of Saudi aggression and the tight sea, land, and air blockade on the country are now at significant risk of death. The rights group criticized the international organizations and other relevant bodies for neglecting Yemeni cancer patients over the past years. Intisaf added that the incidence of leukemia is increasing among Yemeni children, saying the cases of kids suffering from blood cancer have soared from 300 to 700 in the capital Sana'a due to the use of internationally banned weapons supplied by the United States and the United Kingdom and used by Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Approximately 1,000 children are also believed to have contracted leukemia in other Yemeni regions due to the same reasons. The rights organization pointed to the dire shortage of medicine needed for the treatment of patients diagnosed with cancer because of the Saudi-led military onslaught and siege, stating that many children lose their lives as a result. The human rights organization noted that the economic hardships caused by the ongoing military aggression and blockade have prevented minor cancer patients from seeking treatment abroad, calling for the opening of Sana'a International Airport for humanitarian purposes. It finally held Saudi Arabia and its allies fully responsible for all crimes and violations being perpetrated against the Yemeni nation, especially children, urging the international community to bear the legal and humanitarian responsibility for the violations against the civilians. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support from the US and other Western states, launched a devastating war in Yemen in March 2015. The objective was to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen, and reinstalled the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi. The Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve any of its objectives, leaving hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and spawning the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is on the final leg of his trip to Latin America, where he has met with a number of high-ranking officials in an effort to boost bilateral and multilateral relations. Cuba was the latest destination of Amir Abdollahian, where he met with Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel. During the meeting, they discussed matters of mutual interest at bilateral and international levels. The top Iranian diplomat voiced his country's categorical support for Havana while condemning sanctions on Cuba and foreign intervention in its internal affairs. Díaz-Canel, for his part, said despite all the existing pressures, Cuba is determined to cooperate with friendly countries and work with them to eliminate obstacles and challenges lying ahead. The Cuban president criticized U.S. unilateralism and said that his country has earned political independence at a high price and would preserve it. Amir Abdollahian also met with his Cuban counterpart, Bruno Rodriguez Parrilla. Both diplomats wrapped the U.S. sanctions policy against others, including Iran and several South American countries, saying such a policy is doomed to fail. Before Cuba, the top Iranian diplomat paid a visit to Venezuela, which is maintaining strong bilateral relations with Tehran. During a meeting between Amir Abdollahian and Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, the two sides discussed ways to strengthen cooperation further in various fields, including energy. They also called for heightened vigilance in the face of U.S.-led pressure and bullying. Maduro also pointed to common challenges being faced by Venezuela and Iran. Amir Abdollahian also traveled to Nicaragua as part of his Latin American trip. In a meeting with President Daniel Ortega, he condemned unlawful sanctions imposed by the U.S. and certain Western countries on Iranian individuals and entities. He stressed, however, that the Islamic Republic has managed to move forward despite the coercive measures designed to stop the country's progress. Amir Abdollahian voiced Tehran's eagerness for closer cooperation in various fields, saying Iran sets no limits to the promotion of cooperation with Nicaragua. Ortega, for his part, highlighted shared concerns of Tehran and Managua. He said that the two countries have a common enemy, adding that what Iran fought and defeated in 1979 was the same Nicaraguans rose up against in the same year. Amir Abdollahian's visit to Latin America puts under the spotlight the significance of his meeting with officials there. One of the most important points highlighted by almost all leaders was that the ongoing developments in Latin America and elsewhere in the world are creating new opportunities for multilateralism. That was particularly underlined by the top Iranian diplomat, who dismissed unilateralism as an obsolete doctrine on the global stage. He stressed that unilateralism cannot respond to developments and changes taking place worldwide. In the case of Iran and Venezuela, the officials of the two OPEC members found a common ground to solidify their relations to deal with a common enemy, the United States, which has come up with crippling sanctions against them for years. Standing against the U.S. and Western imperialism was another topic of discussion during the Iranian official's visit. That was underscored in Daniel Ortega's comments, where he said the enemies of global peace and tranquility have maintained their imperialistic policies and considered the whole world, not just Latin America, as their backyard. Ortega, however, expressed hope that imperialism cannot last any longer. On sanctions, Latin American leaders echoed the stance of the Iranian foreign minister, who called such measures a terrorist threat being used by imperial powers as leverage. They stressed the need for boosting cooperation in trade and technology, among other things, to overcome those curbs. It seems that shared challenges have brought these countries together to push against U.S. hegemony. And what could make a difference? Moving away from the U.S. dollar, establishing a common currency, enhancing bilateral and multilateral trade. It seems that an oriental shift is largely taking place in today's world. That is visible in countries on the African continent that are trying to enhance ties with the East, namely Russia and China, and Latin American nations that are standing firm against U.S. unilateralism. All these point to their rejection of Western hegemony. We'll be right back. The balloon's journey across the ocean has gripped the world's attention. On Friday, the U.S. military said it mobilized fighter jets, but advised President Joe Biden against shooting the balloon out of the sky for fear debris could pose a safety threat. U.S. authorities said the military took custody of the balloon when it entered America's airspace. On Saturday, however, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the balloon, which was being used by China in an attempt to surveil strategic sites in the continental United States, was brought down above U.S. territorial waters. Pentagon also slammed what it called China's unacceptable violation. China has expressed regret, blaming winds for pushing what it calls civilian airship into U.S. airspace. Beijing said the balloon was used for meteorological purposes and had unintentionally escaped into U.S. airspace. The incident prompted U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken to issue a personal note to his Chinese counterpart condemning Beijing's move.
China's decision to fly a surveillance balloon over the continental United States is both unacceptable and irresponsible. That's what this is about. It's a violation of our sovereignty. It's a violation of international law.
Blinken further added that the U.S. remains committed to diplomatic engagement with China and that he would make a trip to Beijing once conditions are favorable. Some White House allies say postponing Blinken's trip was an overreaction to the incident, particularly because U.S. officials have said that they do not think the balloon was able to gather information that cannot be acquired in other ways, such as spy satellites. In a phone call with his American counterpart, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said China and the United States should handle occasional individual cases in a calm and professional manner. Wang stressed that China has always strictly abided by international laws and will not accept any groundless conjecture or hype. In the face of unexpected situations, what both sides should do is to maintain steadiness, communicate in time, avoid misjudgment, and manage differences. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said it spotted a second similar balloon flying over Latin America. Beijing already denied the U.S. accusation of spying. It accused U.S. media and politicians of using the recent balloon incident as a pretext to launch a smear campaign against Beijing. U.S. allegation of a suspected spy balloon flying in the sky of Montana has added to concerns that the already heightened tensions between Washington and Beijing would further escalate. Although balloons are a powerful potential surveillance tool, it is odd that Beijing would do something this provocative just before a key U.S. diplomatic trip, especially since China has been pushing to repair relations with the United States post-pandemic. Some in the U.S. say it is very likely that China has been using this technique for a while and that the United States was aware of it, but diplomatically chose not to respond. A U.S. Defense Department spokesman confirmed that such intrusions have happened before, saying it is not the first time that you had a balloon of this nature cross over the continental United States. It has happened a handful of other times over the past few years, to include before this administration. Some believe that the United States is spending a large budget on creating unnecessary hostility with China. Some others reason out that the tensions have flared up in recent years between the two, with Biden declaring that China is America's most consequential geopolitical challenge and competition between the two global superpowers is intense. After all, Washington and Beijing are already at loggerheads over a host of issues. That includes tensions over Taiwan. President Biden has antagonized top Chinese officials by saying on several occasions that the United States would defend Taiwan if China attacked a self-ruled island. One close ally of the administration said that although White House officials have walked back those statements, Biden is intentionally sending a message to China when he makes such pronouncements. But tensions between Washington and Beijing are not limited to that. The two powers have deep differences on other issues as well. The economic war between the United States and China, with the two countries having imposed tariffs on each other's goods, can be named as such. The U.S. presence in the South China Sea also adds to concerns that Washington and Beijing would be facing each other militarily. In the current situation, one small excuse would be enough for the whole world to wage another world war.
The United States is ramping up its efforts to counter China's growing regional power. Amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan, Washington and Manila agreed on plans to accelerate the full implementation of the, quote, Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, with the full agreement to designate 4 new agreed locations in strategic areas of the Philippines. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to 4 more bases. Washington has currently 5 bases in the Philippines. The two sides also agreed on the substantial completion of the project in existing agreed locations.
Today, Secretary Galvez and I also reaffirmed our mutual defense treaty commitments. And we'd note that the mutual defense treaty applies to armed attacks on either of our armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft anywhere in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea.
According to experts, Washington's access to those bases could provide U.S. forces a strategic position from which to mount operations in the event of a conflict over Chinese Taipei or in the South China Sea. China has criticized the U.S. for its plan to increase its military presence in the Philippines, warning that granting the U.S. greater access to military bases by Manila could hurt regional stability and raise tensions. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Last year, tensions rose to unprecedented levels after the then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island. China has repeatedly warned against any attempt that delegitimizes its national sovereignty. Furthermore, China claims sovereignty over virtually all of the South China Sea, which is also claimed in part by Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas. In another attempt to counter China, the U.S. has opened an embassy in the Solomon Islands after a 30-year absence as it seeks to boost diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The last U.S. embassy in the Solomon Islands closed in 1993. The move comes after China struck a security pact with Solomon Islands last year. It was the first known bilateral security agreement between China and a country in the Pacific. The region has become the center of a geopolitical and strategic tug-of-war between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, NATO, which is a U.S.-led military bloc, is trying to bolster its ties with Japan in a bid to strengthen an alliance against China. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has visited Japan, saying the Western military alliance will continue to strengthen its partnership with Tokyo.
Beijing is watching closely and learning lessons that may influence its future decisions. What is happening in Europe today could happen in East Asia tomorrow. So we must remain united and firm, standing together for freedom and democracy.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and in recent years, it has expanded its military ties with other Indo-Pacific nations, as well as the United Kingdom, Europe, and NATO. Back in December, Tokyo unveiled a new national security strategy that will see a large increase in its military capabilities. The strategy includes the deployment of long-range missiles. Japan also hopes to ease restrictions on arms export to strengthen its military industry.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Islamic Revolution, Iranian Youth, Hope and Self-Belief. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, these days mark the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. The Islamic Revolution triumphed with the struggles of all strata of people, especially the young generation, who were committed to their historical identity and, with hope in a bright future, fought the tyrannical regime and rescued the society via the inspiring teachings of Islam. This became a role model for other nations to get rid of suffocation and oppression. Stay tuned for more. The Islamic Revolution triumphed in Iran under the circumstances that the world was run by the Western Bloc led by the US and the Eastern Bloc led by the former Soviet Union. The two superpowers had dominated over the globe politically, economically, and militarily. Therefore, any nation which intended to free itself from the domestic despotism would cling to one of the poles of power. At that time, Iran was under a dictatorial regime which was a puppet of Washington. Thus, naturally, any movement was considered to form on the grounds of Marxism as the dominant discourse of revolutionary communities. But the Islamic Revolution gained victory by Imam Khomeini, the great religious leader who had gathered people from all walks of life around the flag of Ashura, and the instructions of Imam Hussein, the younger grandson of the Prophet of Islam. Till early 1970s, nobody believed that the Iranian people could stage an all-out uprising against the mercenary Shah under a religious leader. In fact, what caused public awakening in Iran was the revival of anti-oppression teachings of Islam. The Iranian youth found their missing identity in the justice-seeking beliefs of Islam rather than the imported thoughts like Marxism and socialism. Marxism called religion as the opium of masses, while Islam revived masses against any Western or Eastern tyrannical regime. Furthermore, the Iranian people had bitter memories of the Soviet Union in the separation of Azerbaijan from the motherland and other events in past decades and centuries. Imam Khomeini breathed the spirit of self-belief in the moribund body of the young community and inspired them against the horrific dictatorial regime which enjoyed every support of the US. Thus, they succeeded to overthrow the Shah's regime in a short time. However, 70,000 of the Iranian nation were martyred in the way of the lofty ideals of the revolution. Imam Khomeini was both the political and religious leader of the youth. Religiousness, self-belief, and hope were the three factors in the Iranian young generation which helped them topple the British-installed and American-supported Pahlavi regime. Therefore, they taught the youth in other downtrodden and oppressed countries to stand against tyranny and injustice and regain their historical ideals. The point to note here is that these three factors not only caused the Islamic Revolution triumph, but have helped it remain and flourish till this day, despite unlimited enmity of the global arrogance and Zionism. Iran has gone through innumerable conspiracies during 44 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. These conspiracies include separatist moves on borders, the 8-year imposed Iraqi war, illegal economic and political sanctions with baseless pretexts, and the round-the-clock propaganda campaign against the Iranian nation and government with the US, Zionist, Saudi-hired media. Nevertheless, the Iranian youths have defended the lofty ideals of the Islamic Revolution inexhaustibly. Many analysts and socio-political observers maintain that the Iranian youths will keep appearing more proudly and gloriously in the global arenas despite all hindrances put by the U.S., the Zionist regime, and their lackeys and hangers-on. The Iranian youth have already turned into the role model of freedom-seeking and justice-seeking youth across the world, and the big powers will not be able to stop this trend no matter how much they spend on their lie-disseminating media and terrorist training network here and there.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
حفظ کنه آجای قرائتی رو فهمودن یکی از اقوامی که از دوستان از دنیا رفته بود منو خبر کردن بیا
Once Shaykh Qiraati, one of the prominent Shiite Iranian lecturers, was invited to attend the burial ceremony of one of his relatives. Instead of sitting in a corner, he went beside the corpse and put the shroud away. He took the hand of the dead person and left it down. He did it again with the feet. He opened the eyes of the deceased person and shot it. After doing all this, he said, "This body is useful when it is alive. This body can do good deeds when it is alive. All our body organs can do good deeds when they are alive. However, when we die, the chances of being forgiven fades away." Dear brothers and sisters, this world is a good place to repent for our wrong deeds and to compensate for its outcomes. However, on the Day of Judgment and on the Purgatory, we only come back for a single chance so that you will be forgiven. In this world, we don't need the repentance or regret of others for our deeds. We can directly ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive us. Allah is the fastest accountant of deeds, the same God that is the most merciful is also the fiercest ones. There are no two gods. Thus, ask Allah for His forgiveness before it's getting too much late, and this comes to you. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the US, the Koch fundraising network has signaled a turn against Donald Trump in 2024. The return of one of the biggest spenders in American politics to the presidential primary field posed a direct challenge to the former president Donald Trump's comeback bid. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Washington Post has covered this story and tells us more. The network of donors and activist groups led by conservative billionaire Charles Koch will oppose Donald Trump for the 2024 Republican nomination, mounting a direct challenge to the former president's campaign to win back the White House. The best thing for the country would be to have a president in 2025 who represents a new chapter, Emily Seidel, chief executive of the network's flagship group, Americans for Prosperity, wrote in a memo released publicly on Sunday, 5th of February. The three-page missive repeatedly suggests that Americans for Prosperity is taking on the responsibility of stopping Donald Trump, with Emily Seidel writing, "Lots of people are frustrated, but very few people are in a position to do something about it. Americans for Prosperity is. Now is the time to rise to the occasion." The move marks the most notable example to date of an overt and coordinated effort from within conservative circles to stop Donald Trump from winning the GOP nomination for a third straight presidential election. Some Republicans have grown increasingly frustrated with Trump after disappointing midterm elections in which he drew blame for elevating flawed candidates and polarizing ideas. But absent a consolidated effort to stop Donald Trump, many critics fear he will be able to exploit GOP divisions and chart a course to the nomination as he did in 2016. While the memo didn't name a spending target, Americans for Prosperity's affiliated Super PAC spent more than $69 million in the 2022 cycle, according to the Federal Election Commission disclosures. The Koch Network joins the Club for Growth, another of the largest outside spenders and several of the party's biggest individual donors, such as finance billionaires Kenneth Griffin and Stephen Schwarzman, in signalling their opposition to Donald Trump's current campaign. Others are holding back for now. The salvo from one of the biggest spenders in American politics marks a reversal after sitting out the past two presidential primaries. The Koch Network has stayed on the sidelines since 2015, when it identified five approved presidential candidates, all of whom fell to Trump. To avoid a repeat of that outcome, the network plans to endorse a single candidate by the end of this summer, according to a person familiar with the discussions, who spoke on condition of anonymity because the talks were confidential. Americans for Prosperity Action is prepared to support a candidate in the Republican presidential primary who can lead our country forward and who can win, Emily Seidel wrote in the memo. How Americans for Prosperity follows through on the memo's dramatic aims remains to be seen. The organization has in the past rolled out ambitious plans to influence primaries that did not eventually measure up. In the years since the Koch Network stepped back from presidential primaries, many of its top donors drifted away towards other outfits or their own causes, and many of its most prominent strategists and operatives, such as Mark Short, Tim Phillips, and Mike Roman, moved on to other jobs. Koch has also invested heavily in policy work and community-based organizations outside of direct spending on elections. The decision by the powerful network to challenge Donald Trump marks an escalation of a long simmering feud over the GOP's core policy commitments. Trump's brand of economic nationalism has clashed with the free trade inclinations of the Koch network. The globalist Koch brothers, who have become a total joke in real Republican circles, are against strong borders and powerful trade, Donald Trump wrote on Twitter back in 2018, referring to Charles Koch and his brother David, who died in 2019. Donald Trump and the Koch network have been more aligned on opposing foreign interventions and reducing nonviolent criminal sentences. The industrialist brothers assembled an influential network of groups that have sought to have a major impact in the political process. Sunday's memo expressed frustration with the direction of American politics in the Trump era. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this story and tells us more. The powerful political network led by conservative billionaire Charles Koch waded into the GOP's 2024 presidential primary on Sunday, 5th of February 2023, saying the party needs to turn the page on the past in an apparent turn against former President Donald Trump. The Koch network said it's planning to put its deep-pocketed support behind a Republican candidate in the presidential primary, which it has not done in the past. And the group indicated that candidate will not be Donald Trump, according to a new memo from Emily Seidel, the chief executive officer of the Koch advocacy group Americans for prosperity. Our country must move past the current political situation. We've got to turn the page on the past several years, said Emily Seidel, who is also a senior advisor to the group's political wing, Americans for Prosperity Action. The letter makes no mention of Donald Trump, who has already launched his campaign for the GOP's presidential nomination next year. And CNN reported that Americans for Prosperity Action has confirmed it won't back the former president. The Koch Network is also widely influential in the GOP fundraising space, meaning other major donors would follow its lead in moving away from Donald Trump. Emily Seidel wrote, "The hard truth about the present political landscape is that the Republican Party is nominating bad candidates who are getting rejected by the American people, and the Democratic Party increasingly sees this as a political opportunity to push more extreme policies. To write a new chapter of our country, we need to turn the page on the past, so the best thing for the country would be to have a president in 2025 who represents a new chapter. The American people have shown that they're ready to move on, and so Americans for Prosperity will help them do that," Seidel wrote. No other high-profile Republican has yet entered the ring with Donald Trump for the 2024 cycle, though former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley is expected to announce soon and become the second major name in the running for the Republican nomination. On the Democratic side, President Biden hasn't officially announced he'll run for another White House term, but has said he intends to try for 4 more years and is widely expected to seek re-election in 2024. Since Democrats appear to have already chosen their path for the 2024 presidential election, Americans for Prosperity Action said it seems no room to have a positive impact there, but is prepared to deploy its enormous fundraising apparatus in the Republican race. Americans for Prosperity Action is prepared to support a candidate in the Republican presidential primary who can lead our country forward and who can win, Emily Seidel wrote.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A conference near the UK Houses of Parliament to mark the 12th anniversary of the Bahraini people's uprising against the Al Khalifa regime. A reminder that the reverberations of what happened on Pearl Square in 2011 continue to be felt today.
There is a momentum for the revolution that the crisis has not ended. It is there. It is escalating by the day. It's not really diminishing at all. And it is our feeling that the people will not give up unless there is a good degree of concessions. And my feeling also, the regime cannot do that.
This is what it looked like when the Islamic awakening reached the Kingdom of Bahrain 12 years ago. The protesters' main demands, socioeconomic justice and democracy. What they got from the regime, though, a state of emergency and a violent crackdown that lasted for months, aided and abetted by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Many were killed or injured, many more jailed or exiled, making Bahrain a country with one of the worst human rights records. Yet none of that impacted its relations with the corridors of power here in the UK, which lists Bahrain as a core market for its arms sales.
The relationship that the UK government has is a special relationship because historically it has been an ally of successive repressive regimes for a single purpose, well, a dual purpose. One is obviously the issue with regard to oil, and the second is the strategic importance of Bahrain. And what we've seen is a pattern of governments, successive governments of all political persuasions, put those interests, both strategic and with regard to oil, economic, above the basic civil liberties and human rights of the people of Bahrain.
The kingdom is also host to American and British military bases. Neither country offered any support for the uprising at the time.
Bahrain has an embassy in London, and the UK is one of four European countries to maintain an embassy in Manama. The participants here say it's time the UK government rethought its cozy relationship with the regime in Manama, held it accountable, and stood up for the people of Bahrain. Saeed Bourza, London.
In recent months, Alexei Reznikov has been mixing at the highest levels within NATO and the EU. He's just been sacked as Ukraine's defense minister amid a fresh corruption scandal. There was no mention of this at a press conference following a meeting of EU affairs ministers in Brussels on Monday. It was confirmed, however, that attempts are being made to apply more pressure on Russia over the war in Ukraine.
We continue to work on the 10th package of sanctions to be in place by 24th of February, 1 year after the invasion started.
EU taxpayers have already sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine. Ministers pledged on Monday to keep the money flowing. This as mortgage repayments in the eurozone are going up after the European Central Bank increased interest rates. Citizens have been talking to us about the cost of living crisis.
I bought my house, and so it's very, very hard to pay.
My weekly bill went from, 50 euros per week to 150, and I live alone. So
with 50 euros, you cannot buy some food for a week. You can just buy for 1 or 2 days.
It's several hundred, definitely. Several hundred euros per month.
More than you were paying?
Yeah.
The ECB is raising interest rates to try and control inflation, but it's damaging the EU's competitiveness. There's concern employment will be impacted.
Credit to the private sector is becoming more expensive. Bank lending to firms has decelerated sharply over recent months.
Analysts say EU sanctions against Russia are backfiring as higher energy costs spread throughout the bloc's entire economy. There is no relief in sight for mortgage holders in the eurozone. The ECB has indicated it will increase rates further in March. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Search and rescue efforts are underway in Turkey and Syria after two massive earthquakes rattled large swathes of the two neighboring countries and left thousands dead. Rescuers are digging through piles of the rubble to find possible survivors. But the freezing weather conditions is not only hampering rescue operations, but adding misery to those who left injured or homeless. Concerns are particularly high over the situation in Syria. The natural disaster has multiplied the tragedies Syrians have been going through for over a decade. The devastating quake brings to the spotlight how difficult life has been for millions of those who were displaced by foreign-backed militancy and endured Western sanctions. The crippling curbs have devastated Syria's economy to the extent that the country is unable to recover and reconstruct by its own. Now the same unlawful sanctions are complicating international efforts to assist Syrians who have been affected by the latest quakes. The World Health Organization says Syria's humanitarian needs are the highest, describing the situation as a crisis on top of multiple crises.
WHO recognizes Turkey's strong capacity to respond and considers that the main unmet needs may be in Syria in the immediate and midterm.
That assessment is echoed by other UN officials as well as rescue workers on the ground in northern Syria.
Those people already needed assistance. Now they will need more of that assistance and they need an immediate earthquake-related assistance.
Honestly, the situation is very disastrous. It needs the interference of United Nations organizations and international organizations that are specialized in rescuing, because the situation is very harsh and people are still under the rubble from yesterday.
British activist Vanessa Bealey, who is now in Syria, says the Western sanctions could target anybody who comes to Syria's assistance.
The people who are now homeless are in the streets soaking wet and freezing cold without any alternative shelter and without any electricity, without any heating, without any fuel, because of course we don't have any heating fuel either in the country pretty much. So these shortages combined of course with the Western barbaric sanctions, including the CSAR law that was imposed by the Trump administration, which penalizes any country that even comes to the assistance of Syria. So those countries that can then be sanctioned by default if they come to the aid of Syria, which is, you know, a criminal sanctions regime to impose on any country and quite unprecedented.
Now the Syrian Red Crescent has appealed to Western countries to lift sanctions and provide aid to help the Arab country deal with the aftermath of the devastating earthquakes. The humanitarian organization has also urged the United Nations to facilitate the aid effort, particularly in the militants-held area in northwestern Syria. It says they are ready to deliver relief to those areas if militants open a road for them. The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies said that quick-hit areas may need years to recover from the destruction. It says long-term help will be needed and not just assistance in search and rescue operation for survivors.
They'd warned the next one would be their biggest yet, and they've kept their promise. Tens of thousands of nurses from the Royal College of Nursing Union and ambulance crews on strike, this time together.
No nurses!
No nurses!
No nurses!
The chanting on the picket lines is not just about inflation-busting pay rises, but about the depressing state of the National Health Service. ICU nurse Neve has worked for the NHS for 10 years. It explains to us why she thinks the system is in crisis.
Total underfunding, a lack of foresight, I think, politically, and nurses really just being taken for granted for too long.
And that has meant tens of thousands of trained nurses either leaving the profession or working for the private sector in recent years.
They're calling out for the National Health Service to be kept alive, a system that is now on life support. And many in the medical profession believe that the deeper the crisis gets, the stronger the likelihood that privatization will be foisted upon them.
That's because while the NHS is at breaking point, private health care is flourishing, creating worries about a two-tier system, one for the rich who can pay their way, and another one, a subpar NHS for everyone else.
I hope that it isn't the case that we're moving towards a privatized system. I think it would be disastrous for all of us if that was the case. I think hopefully with these strikes, the public support that we've gained, the government will listen and see that that just isn't, you know, isn't an option. People don't want to lose the NHS.
If gestures of support by passing motorists is anything to go by, public support for the strikers is strong. It remains to be seen which side the British government will decide to be on. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The closing session of the ninth meeting of the Joint Economic Cooperation Committee of Iran and Zimbabwe was held in Tehran. During the meeting, the two sides stressed the importance of bilateral cooperation in the fields of agriculture, health, and facilitating exports of Iranian drugs into the Zimbabwean market. Iran and Zimbabwe officials agreed to use Iran's experiences in various fields, including the development of small and medium-sized enterprises, energy, and science.
Agriculture, exports of machinery, sale of petrochemical products, and technical engineering services are among the existing capacities for broader cooperation between Iran and Zimbabwe.
Speaking at the meeting, Iran's Minister of Cooperatives, Labor and Social Welfare, Solat Mortazavi, said that the current level of commercial and economic relations between the two sides should increase to at least $500 million per year based on high potentials of the two countries.
The current level of commercial and economic relations between the two countries is not satisfactory, and the two countries should use their capacities to increase their volume of bilateral trade to at least $500 million per year. Zimbabwe has been under sanctions for almost 20 years, and Iran can share its experiences with Zimbabwe in various fields, including neutralizing the existing sanctions of the West.
Addressing the meeting, the visiting Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs and Interest